This is KVNF Regional News for Tuesday, April 1st. I'm Patricia Naft. Governor Hickenlooper's top fire official released a new report saying Colorado needs an aerial firefighting fleet for the upcoming wildfire season. As part of our Capital Conversation series, Benta Berklin talks to reporters about the report and how it will factor into the budget debate.
Joining us, we have Joe Hannell with the Durango Herald and Peter Marcus with the Colorado Statesman. Just as the Senate is about to take up the budget in their chamber, we have this huge blow up over the aerial firefighting fleet. Joe, just tell us some of the key highlights in this report.
Well, Benta, this is a rare instance in state government that a report comes out and we're surprised about what's in it, because all year the governor has been distancing himself from the idea that Colorado should have its own firefighting air force. And this year there's a bill out there that Republicans and Democratic senators are to lease 3 helicopters this year and get 4 big air tankers next year. This report comes out and it essentially triples that. It says, despite everything the governor's been saying, we should get 4 helicopters this year, 4 single-engine air tankers, a couple of heavy air tankers, a couple of spotter planes for $33 million, which is a sum of money that it seems like the legislature doesn't have to spend right now because they're just about ready to close the budget.
Senators are saying this report is great and it bolsters our position that we do need more aerial firefighting. At the same time, the governor's office is reading the report and emphasizing the point that the state doesn't need to buy air tankers.
When you read the press release, the talking points on the release point out that the report specifically says do not purchase, right? So we're already quibbling over terminology here, procurement, purchase, contract, you know. In the end, it's all going to be the same to the lawmakers who want to push this. They're already saying we're okay with your contract. The point is we need the $33 million. And this puts the governor in kind of an odd situation. The governor is responsible for fire management and coming up with a plan. And if we have a particularly bad fire season in this state, it just opens the door for folks to point the finger at him and say, why didn't you come up with this money? You had people in your own party who wanted this. You had people on the other side of the aisle who wanted this. Why aren't we funding this? This is perhaps the biggest public safety issue facing the state right now.
And Joe, you have the governor's office. It sounds like they're saying, look, air tankers are just one small piece of the overall firefighting puzzle.
They're a small piece, but they're a very expensive piece. Now, to make a gross oversimplification, air tankers, helicopters, they're really useful when a fire is starting to blow up and it's in a remote area or it's threatening some houses, and lay down some water fire retardant on it and maybe kind of nip it in the bud. When the fire gets a lot bigger, the air tankers you see on TV with a big, huge 100-foot flames, and they call those CNN drops because it gives the illusion that something is being done. And I think the report pretty much acknowledges that. Nevertheless, it says we should really spend $33 million because the initial attack would be worth it.
And just finally, what I find interesting, a lot of times with this governor, he'll kind of sit and wait, and he won't comment on things that are controversial until they may reach his desk. A lot of things flounder through the legislative process. So he has been more out front with this. He's been, I guess, as Joe said, distancing himself from this idea.
To be fair to the governor, what he's been suggesting is potentially sharing an aerial firefighting fleet with other states. But at this point, I mean, it's going to be hard for him to run from a report from, you know, his own fire director, from requests from both sides of the aisle. This is go time.
Okay, thanks. That was Peter Marcus with the Colorado Statesman and Joe Hannell with the Durango Herald. I'm Benta Berklin in Denver, and you've been listening to Capital Conversation.
The Colorado Department of Transportation is trying to get more rural drivers to wear their seatbelts. The state agency is partnering with rural sheriff and police departments to step up enforcement of seatbelt laws for the next week. According to CDOT, last year, rural residents accounted for nearly 60% of all deaths of people not wearing seatbelts. Most of those who died were men, and nearly 30% of them were driving a pickup truck. El Paso, Weld, and Lincoln counties had the most unbuckled fatalities. Various law enforcement agencies on the Western Slope will be participating in the seatbelt campaign. That includes Glenwood Springs, Rifle, and Silt's police departments, as well as the Colorado State Highway Patrol. The police officers will be looking for speeding and aggressive driving, but if they stop someone who isn't wearing a seatbelt, they will be fined $65. Last September's floods along the Front Range inundated over 25,000 oil and gas wells and spilled nearly 100,000 gallons of oil and other contaminants. Earlier this month, the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission released a report on the lessons they learned from the floods. They found that despite the amount of oil and chemicals spilled, there was no trace of pollution left behind. That's because there was so much flood water rushing through. KDNK's Ed Williams asked Alan Gilbert of the state's Oil and Gas Commission to explain how to protect wells and the environment during floods.
Probably the most important recommendation in our mind is to have what's called remote shut-in capability for all wells located near drainages. And what that means is that an operator from a long distance away can decide that there's a danger to the well and send a signal to the well and actually shut it off so that there won't be major spillage if something happens at the well location. The second example I'd give you is we found that what's called secondary containment, which is really a way to contain spills from well pads, works when that secondary containment is built as very robust metal fences with liners attached to them. And that compares to secondary containment that is just earthen berms. We saw the earthen berms wash away often in the floods in September, but we saw that these stout metal barriers really protected oil and gas equipment.
Well, on that note, there is one recommendation I'd like to touch on that's locally significant for us here on the Western Slope, and that is that no open pit, you know, an open chemical pit, should be allowed within a designated distance from the ordinary high watermark of a waterway. The recommendation says that any existing pit within these areas near waterways should be removed and reclaimed. Now, in our area, we see a lot more of these open chemical pits near rivers and waterways because of our topography. There's no other really flat place for the operators to put these facilities. But talk about that recommendation. What would that entail? It sounds like a really big effort to clear such facilities from waterways.
There are very few pits in the area that was affected by the September 2013 floods, so it didn't turn into a problem, but it would have been a problem had the pits been there. The obvious balance to that idea, the idea that pits not be located close to drainages, is just what you said. In areas with very steep slopes and few flat areas, there's not a lot of choice sometimes about where to place equipment and pits and so on. So I think the best thing I can say to you is it is an idea we want to explore and pursue, but we are very well aware of the kinds of limitations to the idea that you're raising, and we need to discuss those further with the operators in areas of steep slopes and other people affected by that kind of idea.
Stay tuned for the Tuesday Morning Music Mix with Chase. For KVNF News, I'm Patricia Naft.